Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Health Report and Explorations, coming up after As It Is.
Welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Today we hear about a group of Koreans who recently were reunited with family members for the first time in more than half a century. The meetings took place at Mount Kumgang in North Korea. Later, we hear about North Korea's detention of a Christian missionary from Australia. Reports say the North is holding John short, possibly because he was carrying religious materials. Long-separated Korean families and the arrest of an Australian man are our subjects today on As It Is. Last week, a group of older South Koreans met their North Korean family members for the first time. The Korean War has separated these families for 60 years. Christopher Cruz has this VOA story.
82 South Koreans and 180 North Koreans met at a resort named Mount Kumgang on North Korea's east coast. The event was carefully guarded, but it also was filled with emotion. Many of the South Korean families were filled with joy at the long-awaited reunions. They exchanged gifts and family photos. They shared stories. But the joy was colored with sadness. They know this may be the last time they will ever see or even talk to their relatives again. Both governments ban phone calls and even letters between the two Koreas. Lee Sang-chul is a representative of the South Korean Association of Divided Families. He has called for regular reunions of families separated since the Korean War. He says, "We are running out of time. Right now, only about 100 people from each side are allowed to come to the family reunions. Divided families want both governments, North and South Korea, to increase the number of people able to join." Millions of Koreans were separated in the 1950s conflict. Most have died without ever seeing their relatives again. Since 2000, about 130,000 South Koreans have put their names on a reunion waiting list. Just over half are still alive. Many of these people are in their 80s. They have given up hope of seeing their loved ones. These are the first family reunions held since 2010, and they almost did not happen. North and South Korea are officially still at war. Bad feelings between the two sides have recently been increasing. For weeks, North Korea threatened to cancel the reunions if South Korea went forward with joint military exercises with the U.S. North Korea agreed to the reunion last week. The agreement comes after a high-level meeting that many people hope can serve as a first step towards improving relations. Troy Stangaron is a senior director at the Washington-based Korean Economic Institute. He tells VOA that these reunions are especially important because relations between the North and South have recently weakened.
So over the last year, we've had a lot of tension between North and South Korea as you transitioned into Kim Jong-un, and this is sort of the first real step of progress between the two Koreas in that period.
Others are not so sure. They do not feel that the reunions reflect any major change in North Korea's policy towards the South. Lee Sung-yoon is a Korea Studies professor at Tufts University. Professor Lee says the reunions are important to the families involved. He does not believe, however, that they have helped relations between North and South Korea. A second meeting involving 82 South Koreans and 180 North Koreans took place last weekend. It is not clear when or if other reunions will follow. I'm Christopher Cruz.
North Korea detained a 75-year-old Australian man last week. John Short was visiting North Korea's capital, Pyongyang. Karen Leggett has more on the story.
John Short and his wife, Karen Short, are Christian religious workers, or missionaries. They have lived in Hong Kong for more than 50 years. VOA reporters spoke to Ms. Short by telephone at the couple's home in Hong Kong. They asked about her husband's recent detainment. Karen Short says her husband has no political goals for visiting North Korea. She added that her husband was most likely seized for having religious material written in the Korean language.
He believed it was the right thing to go, and he cares about the situation there and the people there, and wanted to go and make a difference, be there, see the people, and let them see him.
Short says her husband is not political and never has been, but she says they were aware of the dangers in visiting North Korea. They know that North Korea severely restricts organized religion, and Christian missionaries are accused of foreign interference. Ms. Short said her husband was able to pass on religious material to the people of North Korea on an earlier trip to the country, but she said he did so carefully. She said government officials were assigned to stay with him and were always watching him. She says this time, he must have done something to draw attention to himself or anger government officials. But she said she does not know what that could have been. Ms. Short also explained that she and her husband know the risks that go along with being missionaries.
This is obviously not the outcome that you think would happen, but we also realize that it's not a free country, it's a closed country, and there are risks involved in going, but that didn't hold back my husband to go.
John Short is at least the second Christian missionary to be detained in North Korea. 45-year-old Korean-American Kenneth Bae was arrested in 2012. He was found guilty of trying to overthrow the government. Mr. Bae is currently serving a 15-year sentence of hard labor. Ms. Short is not sure if the same thing will happen to her husband. She said she will deal with that reality if or when it happens. The Australian government has said that it will do all it can to get Mr. Short out of prison. But Australia and North Korea do not have diplomatic relations. Australian officials, then, must work with other countries, that do have diplomatic relations with North Korea, such as Sweden. I'm Karen Leggett.
Thank you for joining us today. For the latest world news, be sure to listen to VOA at the top of the hour, Universal Time.
The Health Report is next, followed by Explorations. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health Report. Even though malaria can be both prevented and treated, the disease is the third biggest killer of children in the world. Malaria is caused by bites from insects called mosquitoes. People who sleep in beds covered by special nets are less likely to be infected. When the nets are used correctly, they prevent the flying insects from biting people as they sleep. Susan Eckert is a Peace Corps volunteer in the West African country of Burkina Faso. Malaria is responsible for about 9,000 deaths there every year.
Malaria is everywhere. People live with it just the way we live with a common cold. They blame everything on malaria. They're not aware of how it's transmitted. They have become reliant on treatment rather than prevention.
As soon as someone reports a high body temperature, they are given medicine to treat malaria. Ms. Eckert says malaria medicine is used at the first sign of sickness because it costs less than the test to identify the disease. There is a lot of misunderstanding about malaria and a lack of good information.
They do get a lot of information about illnesses and they confuse them all. So they're not sure if they're talking about cholera or malaria or AIDS.
In 2011, the Peace Corps launched Stomp Out Malaria in Africa. Peace Corps volunteers are trained so they can be directly involved in education to prevent malaria. Ms. Eckert is one of the volunteers who presents lessons in fun ways that will help the children remember.
The one that was the most fun was a tag game where one or two kids played the roles of mosquitoes and would, if they tagged someone, that person became infected and had to sit down.
Susan Eckert teaches students from first grade through fifth grade. Older children who had attended a leadership camp came to help with the games. The older children also translated the malaria information into the local Dogara language.
One of our volunteers wrote a very good song to the tune of We Will Rock You, and it came out as We Can Stop Malaria, with stomping and clapping, and the kids just loved it.
Children also acted in short plays and wrote and sang songs about malaria.
We are living in the villages with the villagers, and we can introduce these subjects in a casual conversation over a calabash of the local beer.
It is too soon to tell how much of the important information in the songs and games is shared with families. But Susan Eckert says using Peace Corps volunteers to spread the word on preventing malaria is a good idea. Being part of the community means sharing knowledge, she adds, especially about something as important as malaria. And that's the Health Report. You can find more information at www.stompoutmalaria.org. This is Learning English from the Voice of America in Washington. I'm Jim Tedder.
From VOA Learning English, this is Explorations in Special English. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Kelly Jean Kelly. Today, we report on new knowledge about Stonehenge, the famous ancient stone circles in southern England.
Laser technology has aided scientists with their knowledge of Stonehenge, the stone monument near the city of Salisbury, England. Most of the stones at Stonehenge stand in incomplete circles. One of the largest stones weighs about 40,000 kilograms. Some stones are more than 7 meters high. Others lie broken on the ground. The mysterious stone formation has stood on the flat, windy Salisbury Plain for perhaps 5,000 years. But the organization English Heritage used modern technology to solve some of that mystery. Researchers working for English Heritage reported what they found after directing lasers at some of the stones. The lasers showed bright gray-white surfaces under material collected on the stones over the ages. And the intense light seemingly identified an ancient secret. The uncovered surfaces appear to have been cut and shaped with a clear purpose. The researchers say the designers of Stonehenge wanted to improve the ability to see sunlight through the circles twice each year.
Some people believe the designers of Stonehenge wanted to make the best showing possible of sunlight on the longest day of the year. That day is known as the summer solstice. The designers also may have shaped stones to capture the sunset on the shortest day of the year, the winter solstice. The effect of the light passing through spaces between the stones has brought many people to the monument on those special days. Sometimes clouds cover the sun, but the people come anyway.
Researchers say Stonehenge's ancient architects placed importance on what people could see from northeast of the monument. It is thought that travelers came toward the stone circle in that direction on a path from the Avon River. The pathway is one of Stonehenge's two avenues. The stones on the northeast side are the biggest and the most similar to each other on the monument. The southwestern part has smaller stones. The smaller ones are less alike and have not been improved like the others. The placement of the stones raises many questions. For example, why did the builders of Stonehenge use and improve their best stones on that side? Did they think that was the most important part of the monument?
Tests with lasers also show 71 images of axe heads. The images were carved into the stones. Researchers say the artists probably lived during the early Bronze Age. That would have been about 1,000 years after Neolithic people first worked on Stonehenge. The lasers also show graffiti and other damage done by 19th century visitors. At that time, people were permitted to remove pieces of the stones. They could pay workmen to break off pieces to take home as souvenirs.
For many years, some people believe that Stonehenge was used as an observatory for watching the skies, or a place to worship the sun. Others thought the stone circles formed a calendar, but other theories are gaining support. Researcher Mike Parker Pearson, for example, says Stonehenge was built to help unite what now is Eastern and Western Britain. These areas had suffered long years of conflict and battle. Professor Parker Pearson is with the University of Sheffield. He leads a team called the Stonehenge Riverside Project. That project has been studying the stone circle and places linked to it for almost 10 years.
Professor Parker Pearson says the early people were developing a common culture. Changes in earthenware and ways of life showed that people were traveling. They were learning about cultures other than their own. But the professor's main idea about the purpose of Stonehenge is that it served as a burial ground. Some human remains found near the stone circles show physical injury or disease. This helped lead two well-known researchers to propose that Stonehenge was a refuge or shelter for people with health problems. Archaeologists Jeffrey Wainwright and Timothy Darville propose that Stonehenge may have served as a place to heal the sick. Like Mike Parker Pearson, the two archaeologists have worked for years to try to solve the mysteries of the circles.
The archaeologists based their theory of Stonehenge's purpose partly on qualities of blue stones used at the monument. The stones are placed in a double circle, with the entrance facing northeast. During the past century, the blue stones were shown to be from the Preseli Mountains in Wales. Their name comes from their color. Some people say the stones appear to be blue when they are wet or cut. The archaeologists note that some blue stones in modern Wales are still part of a healing tradition. In some places, people use water poured over the stones in an effort to cure sickness.
Archaeologists Wainwright and Darville made an important discovery at Stonehenge in 2008. They dug up about 100 pieces of organic material from where the first blue stones were placed. From this discovery, they say the blue stone circle was built about 4,300 years ago. A number of theories have been proposed to explain how the heavy stones made their way to the Salisbury Plain. Some geologists have suggested that glaciers, huge ice formations, carried the stones. But hundreds of kilometers separate the mountains in Wales from the windy English plain.
Efforts to transport the heavy stones by boat on the river sank the boat, and attempts to row the stones across land showed that it would have taken months to move them a relatively short distance. Some experts, however, note that ancient people had lots of time and may have been more than willing to do the labor. Another mystery is how people raised the stones to standing positions. Some weigh 4 tons. One experiment used specially shaped stone balls. The balls were rolled on long pieces of wood. Each piece was cut like a rail or long bar. Professor Bruce Bradley of Exeter University reported that a demonstration using this method was successful. He said about 10 oxen could have moved as many as 10 stones a day, up to 16 kilometers.
For many years, experts thought ancient people stopped using Stonehenge and the area around it, perhaps 3,500 years ago. But in 2000, British scientists learned that people may have come to Stonehenge much later. They identified human remains as those of a man executed there and used radiocarbon dating to find the time of his death. The finding was made because of a rediscovery. Partial skeletons, sets of bones, of many people were unearthed in the 1920s and 1930s. One skeleton was identified as that of a man who was killed near Stonehenge. The man died when he was hit with the sharp metal edge of a sword that cut off his head. The experts say he was about 35 years old at the time of his death.
Experts say the earliest the man could have been killed was about 2,100 years ago. About that time, people in Britain first started using iron. Or the man could have been killed during a Roman invasion several hundred years later. The Roman Emperor Vespasian supposedly executed local leaders by cutting off their heads. However, the ancient man may have died hundreds of years later. He may have been killed during wars between competing English kings.
The skeleton was first discovered in 1923. A British military officer named William Hawley dug it up from inside Stonehenge's ancient circles. It was shown to the public and kept at the Royal College of Surgeons in London. German bombs badly damaged the college during World War II. 19,000 objects from its collection were taken to houses in the countryside for safekeeping. They included the skeleton. After the war, it was returned to the medical school, but no one knew it was there. It was thought to have been destroyed in the bombing.
In 2000, archaeologist and writer Mike Pitts was working in the National History Museum in London when he discovered the remains. Mr. Pitts has since described feeling an emotional moment in the presence of the earthly remains of a person who lived and died so long ago. Like the mysteries of Stonehenge, the full story of the executed man probably will remain secret. This Explorations in Special English was written by Geralyn Watson. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Kelly Jean Kelly. Join us next week for more news about science in VOA Special English.